Hello and welcome to Royale Without Cheese, our bi-weekly podcast in which we discuss both the classic and the unknown of art and popular cinema from the then and now. We are your hosts, me, Tomás Ferreira, and Miguel Aido.
Hi there.
This is our talk show segment where we welcome grand indie filmmakers to our wonderful couch and discuss their work. Here with us we have Marcelo Zarbos, the Brazilian-born pianist and film composer, twice nominated for the Primetime Emmy Awards, which credits include Robert De Niro's The Good Shepherd, American Ultra, the Oscar-nominated film Fences by Denzel Washington, and The Latest Bear by Todd Haynes, Dark Waters, and May December. Today we'll be discussing May December and Marcelo's overall process as a music composer, whose sound is described as a seamless blend between classical, orchestral, rock, electronic, and ethnic elements. So, Marcelo, how are we feeling today?
Very good. Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Tomás and Miguel. It's good to be talking to you guys.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Yeah. Well, first and foremost, we need to say congratulations on the success of May December, because not only did it receive the Palme d'Or last year, well, the nomination for the Palme d'Or last year at Cannes, but also four recent nominations for the Golden Globes and a Best Original Screenplay nomination as well for the Oscars. But we have to say, the music is very well deserving of attention because it's very much a part of the film's personality, we found. And curiously enough, we need to point out how the film incorporates the score of the 1971 film The Go-Between, but you adapted it into new layers of instrumentalization and dramatic effect to illuminate the ideas in May December, kind of blending the main piano chords with what I found to be this inquisitive ambience electronic music and this percussive bass sound that added to the tension, the suspense, and at times even a strings instrument that I perhaps think that is a piano. So really the kickstart question would be, we were wondering, what made you both, you and Todd, attracted by the score in The Go-Between? Because it is quite an interesting scenario to pick something from another film. And then secondly to that, in what ways did you reinterpret it to go further and make it an original part of May December? Are there any of the instruments that I mentioned true to the final form, or am I imagining things?
No, your assumption is correct. I mean, the it was an adaptation. Todd wanted all along to use that music. He felt like there was something about that very bombastic kind of theme that was going to work well with the story. I think part of what we found was that almost the sort of foreign nature of this music, the fact that it was from another film, from another time, and even it was a period film, and it kind of like has this sort of a Baroque sort of sound to it. It helped keeping the viewer sort of a bay, if you will, a little removes the viewer. In many ways, this is the use of music in May December breaks all the conventions of film scoring that I certainly have lived by up until that point. And I think the fact that it was a pre-existing music was sort of integral to that, because there's something very kind of non-inflexible about the music, if you will, where when it comes, it kind of pushes you off in a way. And so as opposed to a lot of film music, certainly a lot of the film music I have written over the years, where you're inviting the audience, you're kind of seducing them gently or not gently, but somehow you're bringing them in, this music was also meant to do the opposite. And it means to, like, whenever you think you understand what's happening here, this music kind of jolts you out. In a way, it worked like that a little bit on the original in The Go-Between, but I think Todd felt something that could be used here to greater effect. I mean, it's a much more, I mean, The Go-Between is a beautiful film and the music is used in this very bombastic way as well. But I think Todd wanted to go even further and also to adapt it to a more modern sound. We re-recorded everything. I had to transcribe all this music and then adapt it to a more modern sound, which was something that was important for Todd. Sometimes the adaptation was as simple as cutting elements out. Sometimes it could be as complicated as, you know, changing chords and instrumentation. And so there, it ran a gamut. And then I also wrote a bunch of original music to fill in certain spots where that music simply was not what he was looking for. Mm-hmm. And in a couple of places, it was somewhere in between where I wrote pieces that were kind of somewhat inspired by the Legrand, but still went in its own way. So there was a little bit of everything, but always the idea was for this theme that you hear in the very beginning and the very end of the film to be the main line, the main sort of through line of the whole experience. And Todd came very kind of sure of what he was doing. I have to say that I was a little bit taken aback because I've never had to do this before. And of course, once I, you know, working with somebody like Todd Haynes, I mean, he's not a conventional director. And I think in many ways, this is a more radical extension of what he did with the music of Far From Heaven, where Elmer Bernstein was kind of adapting his own style of doing old, you know, the old melodramas from the 50s that he worked on and created this thing that was still very much sounded like a 50s score. And I think here, Todd wanted to go even further. I mean, I think in this age of like sampling and of like people curating things and all of that, it felt to me like a very modern approach. I think it, I knew it was gonna bother some people. I mean, some people were bothered by the fact that it comes from a film, and I respect that. I mean, I approached it really more as a classical music piece. I remember talking a lot to Todd about a movie that we share our love for, Barry Lyndon, for instance, the film, where they use a piece of Handel and they really use that bam, bam, da, dam, bam, ba, 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 you know, that piece. And it's reorchestrated, rearranged. But of course, that was Handel, you know, it was not in a movie. And so this, what we did was a little bit more tricky in some ways. But I think it works very, very well. And I think as I started to see how the music, I started to understand more what Todd was going for. And he was really like, he's a very, you know, like a lot of very visionary filmmakers, he's kind of ahead of everybody else. And certainly even of the people that are working with him in the film, we, you know, I was obviously as the composer, a little bit taken aback, but then I was also thinking, wow, this is Todd Haynes. You know, I mean, this is a director that I respect enormously and really, really enjoy the process of working with him. So let's see where this ends up. And it was a very unique experience, and but I think it's undeniable how effective the music is. I mean, it's certainly one of the most talked about aspects of the film. And I think the fact that it came from an outside source was integral for that. And this is something that I realized as we were doing it, and as I started to seeing it kind of come together, so to speak.
It's interesting that you spoke of classical music because at the time, I mean, pieces were also commissioned for operas or even events like funerals. So it's a weird criticism to make just because of a piece of music came from another art form because, you know, that happened all the time in classical time.
It's true. I you know, I'm not one for, you know, I feel like being a purist in film is like, it's, I think it can be kind of, depends on who's doing. In the case of Todd Haynes, or in the case of many, many great directors that I've worked with, it's all about the storytelling. You know, the way that I always see the role of music in film is that we are part of the cast and we are like an invisible character in the film. Sometimes, like in the case of May December, this character is screaming at the top of their lungs in front of everybody else. Sometimes it's very subtle and very kind of like fences, and it's very gentle under the dialogue. There's all kinds of ways that one can do this. But with Todd, I feel like one of the great things is that he's always having a conversation with film history in his films. He's a director, like, and I feel like he's not alone. I think Martin Scorsese is similar in that way, where they are thinking of, they're having a conversation with film from, you know, from the beginning of film history, let's say. And of course, sometimes even beyond with painting and you know, literature and theater. But in the case of Todd, I feel like he's, you know, one of the things that was really interesting is this one, I came in very early, and I was able to kind of be exposed to Todd's lookbook, which was fantastic for the film. All the images that many times directors, they will come up with a lookbook that has images from anywhere that give you an idea of what the tone of what they're looking for. But in Todd's lookbook, there was also an incredible list of films that he wanted us to look. I don't know if everybody watched everything. I certainly did because they were also fantastic films. Of course, Persona was in that list, and I think that that's the film that comes to mind a lot. There's an element of May December that is very much by Todd's own kind of, admission, is there is a real element. I wouldn't call it an homage because I feel like he's being inspired, and I just saw this this great quote by Godard that, who was not afraid of borrowing things from anywhere, and he said, you shouldn't be, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially it's like, it's not important where you took it from. What's important is where you're taking it to, where you're taking that material to, and I think in the case of Todd Haynes, it definitely, this became something very different from the go-between and served the purpose of this film. But other films, we talked about Autumn Sonata as well, another Bergman film. Of course, The Graduate and The Go-Between and many others. But it was, he comes to it. It's not like a random thing where he's just, oh, I heard this piece in the radio. I kind of want to try it in my movie. It came with a lot of thought. And I think even though he tried to explain to me why was it that it was working, it was not until I really saw it as a whole that I really understood what he was going for. And I think, like in the case of great art, we don't really necessarily know what a visionary director is going for because they are a visionary, and that's the whole point, is that they're not simply doing a repetition of either their own work from the past or somebody else's work. May December is unlike any film that I've worked on, and I think any film out there. And I think that use of music was crucial for that effect. There was something very naturalistic about the film, the way that it's shot. It's perhaps one of the least stylized of the Todd Haynes films, perhaps the most natural. They shot it very fast. It's not a very fancy kind of lots of set pieces and kind of it's a more natural approach. But so the music was even more shocking, I think, when it comes on. It's very like off-putting, in an interesting way. And it also, one of the comments that I heard from people was that they felt like they knew the characters less by the end of the film than they knew it in the beginning. And I really agree with that. I feel like that's also part of what the music does, is that it keeps you think you know these people, but you really don't. And I think to the very end, to the very, very final frame of this film, with Natalie Portman's character in that movie set, it keeps kind of like people keep changing in front of you. I think certainly that's something that Todd is not interested in, was the idea of morality, like in the sense of, oh, here's the good person, here's the bad person. I think we can all agree that Charles Madden's character was certainly victimized by both women in the end of the day. But as far as Gracie and Elizabeth, it's hard to kind of know where they stand. I think in the end, you kind of, my own, and this is not necessarily Todd's vision, but my own vision is that they're both kind of monstrous kind of women, and they kind of like, have these things that they want to do, and they don't care, if it's going to hurt somebody or not. But I feel like the brutality of the music showed more of that element of these characters, even though you don't really see it in their acting, and or you just the pieces come together as the movie unfolds. And that's, I think, also something that I love about his movies, is just the interest. And as Natalie Portman's character talks about when she's in the workshop with the kids, the theater workshop with the high school kids, is like the gray zone is where all the interesting things happen. And when there is that question of like, can you play somebody bad, really bad, and is that a good thing? And I feel like the movie asks these questions, and I think the music helps sort of remind it keeps reminding us of that.
I find it very interesting, the circular nature of the music, and also because it's so overtly dramatic, in borrowing kind of the nature of how music is in, I mean, my mind goes to soap operas in a weird way, in the punctuation of the dramatic scenes. Even while the classic scene is watching Julianne Moore opening the fridge and saying, "I think we don't have enough hot dogs," with that punctuation of the music. But really, I think it's so, like you say, off-putting to the audience that it contributes to a cynical view of the audience of what is going on very early on, and it informs of who these characters are. I feel really that it really grabs our attention to how performative music for film can be. And in having that thought of how performative film music can be, it actually rhymes very well with Natalie Portman's character. One of the moments that music in this film really shocked me was the moment where Natalie Portman is going through those magazines, kind of gathering information about Gracie in her early life, the case and all. And despite Gracie being a complex character and having her bad ways, and the character of Charles Melton being victimized, it is it, she's looking at really a hard times at hard times in the life of a person, a real person that she's trying to represent. But the music seems to, in that moment, mock Natalie Portman's attempt or her character attempt at representing this person, because everything she does, every gesture, just seems like she herself is mocking the life of this person, of Gracie and Joel. Everything is a kind of a mockery. In this attempt of being faithful, it seems like she's playing, oh, let's pretend it's light stuff. And the music is just synced to every little gesture that she makes, even when she looks at the mirror, there's a violin that comes in, and there's just this balance that I thought very interesting between seriousness and a humor to it, satirically speaking, yeah.
Definitely. The humor, I think it was an interesting thing. I mean, I think Todd's films over the years have been a lot of things, but funny is not one of them. With they tend to be very there's humor in them, but not like he's never really trying to be funny. But I think the music, and perhaps, that very short cue that he described, the hot dog cue, allowed us to kind of like also look at all of this with a little bit of a grain of salt. But one of the things that you mentioned in the beginning was something that Todd really keyed in, was this, as you said, the circular quality of this music. The reason he really wanted to use that theme is because this theme has, once you hear it once, you kind of can guess where it's going to go. And it was very important to him to keep that going. So when the music happens, it kind of has its own life, and it's not really reacting to the images. It's almost more like there's a great film that I love called Contempt or Le Mépris, The Dark. And that's a wonderful, wonderful score by Georges Delerue and another great French composer. But what they use this same piece of music over and over again for happy scenes and sad scenes, funny scenes, comedic scenes. And in a way, what starts to happen is that the film, in a sense, is scoring the music. And so the same piece of music ends up having all these different meanings depending on what is happening on the screen. There's also, very many famous experiments where people would show a face of a person, but not a picture, not a photo, like an actual film actor. And they played these different pieces of music, and it made us think that like the person was changing their acting very in a very subtle way, but the music gives that impression. And I think that music works very much in that way here, where it's sometimes when, especially when you hear repeated cues come back under very different circumstances, it the film essentially is altering the meaning of the music as well, which is a very interesting thing. And again, the fact that it was a pre-existing music allows for that to be even more apparent, that process of the music taking on different meanings depending on what's happening on the screen.
Yeah,
It's
so
almost like
interesting.
the music is asking the audience if they really understood a scene because they hear the same thing and it's a completely different tone, so maybe I didn't quite get it. And it's interesting to raise that sort of thought.
Exactly. I think that there is a, I think one of the big goals of the music in May December is to keep us sort of destabilize our perception of the story and kind of just throwing us off constantly, kind of like, and also even just the sheer volume of the music. I mean, I've never worked on a film where the music was as loud, mixed as loud as this. Most of the time, it's not under dialogue, but nevertheless, it is meant to kind of to shock you.
So listening to the score of this film as well as others like Dark Waters, one can tell the influence of the piano in your writing style. It's always an ever-present instrument. And so considering this and your classical training, and As a pianist myself, I was curious, does the piano always initiate your compositions? And how do you ascertain the exact instrumentalization you want for the project you're working on?
I mean, I try at this point. I've written so many piano-based scores, that of course I try to get out of, and I always joke to myself that, this is the time I'm not going to use piano on a score, and then kind of like it comes back. Sometimes I manage, but the piano is the most direct connection I have with music. I used to beat myself up a lot about it because, it was this a limiting thing, because the piano is so, it's so ever present, but it's also very freeing and allows me to express things very directly with no filters whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, one of the really most satisfying experiences I had with piano music on a score was on Dark Waters. There's a very long cue halfway through the movie, we call the Teflon Connection, when Mark Ruffalo's character figures out what's happening, and it's a 13-minute long solo piano cue. And I remember this was first time working with Todd, and I was like, you're out of your mind, that we're gonna do a solo piano piece, very improvisatory and all of that stuff. But the thing with the piano is that it can be a lot of things, I mean, so many great composers wrote at the piano, from Stravinsky to, Ryuichi Sakamoto and many others. It's a real A lot can be said with the piano. I rarely will I push the piano on a score because I feel like I've done in a lot of different ways. But even the fact, and this one fantasy I've had for a long time was, wouldn't it be great to score a movie with only classical piano pieces, but have me play it and adapt, in a certain way, like what we ended up doing with May December, but let's say go back to Chopin and all of like kind of what happens on Autumn Sonata, for instance, when you hear all those different Chopin pieces being played. I think in the end, it's a real extension of what I do. That's how I experience music, is through the piano. And I would say that maybe half of the time I'll start on a piano. Sometimes I'll start on a keyboard. Sometimes I just hear something in my head. But it is more than a tool for me. It's a direct form of expression, and that I find that sometimes you could have things that are extremely subtle, extremely gentle, extremely minimal, that are very, very effective using a piano. And sometimes it's just about playing it. Like when I was working on Dark Waters, I more or less wrote that long cue with Todd in the room. I set him up in my studio and put him in a booth, so he could talk to me while I was playing, and I would be playing and he would be talking on my headphones, and say, I like that, I do this, do that, and kind of direct me in real time. And I find that directness a very exciting thing to have on a film. And in the case of May December, there was something about the brutality of the performance of the piano. For the most part, it's me playing. There's a couple of things where that are very, very hard that I brought in a player, like the really fast pieces, like what happens in the graduation and stuff, that are very, very hard to play. But most of the music that we associate with it, the pa-pum, pa-pum, ta-da-ta-da, we recorded with this a very, very fine classical pianist, but it was not brutal enough, so I had to go and kind of redo them again. So there was an element also of the performance that was very interesting on May December, where this fantasy of mine of using pre-existing music and really zeroing in on the performance was something that we could really experiment here and not be thinking necessarily about, is this, am I going to change this note or that note, and more like, how much can performance affect a score? And in the case of a pre-existing music, obviously a lot, because that's one of the main parameters that you have left to experiment with as you're actually recording the music.
And how would you say you defined the instrumentalization after you've started on the piano?
For mid-December, I mean, we knew there was going to be strings, I mean, so strings was a big part of, and woodwinds, so we wanted to use the instrumentation from the original. So May December is a little bit, it's not a great example because it was kind of set there, from the first few Legrand pieces. It was basically, it was what it was, you know. It was harp, piano, and strings, and some woodwinds, and that was it. So it was pretty much there. But even in those pieces, there are times where we added electronics and synthesizers. Even the LeGrand pieces themselves, at times, there are like synths that are playing along with it, that are not necessarily something that you quite. They're not very explicit, but they alter the character of the music. And Todd wanted us to add some rubs and some kind of dissonance, even more dissonance at times, to the music. And in some cases, was the pieces that I was writing originally anyway. So, like the stuff when Elizabeth is walking in the corridor in the high school, we kept adding more and more sort of eerie detuned pads and things like that. That's one of the original pieces. But then, of course, also all the very ambient pieces, the ones that were very drony and kind of, and interestingly enough, the drone that you hear is actually, I wrote a lot of variations to the LeGrand music. And then we created a drone by layering 15 or 20 tracks of piano on top of each other to the point where it becomes kind of like just very cacophonous. And that becomes the base of this drone, you know. So even the drone itself, in a way, was derived from the LeGrand. But with me playing, and it was like just very, very loud music, when you add a lot of layers, it starts to cancel each other out, and it becomes this wash of sound and this kind of drone thing that is very satisfying. But we knew that we wanted to use electronics for those specific scenes, you know, and like at the pet shop, also in a couple of the Gracie scenes when she's really freaking out with Charles Melton's character about the cake and about this and that. So we wanted to have, and I think in some ways I feel like those dark moments really capture Gracie's, Julianne Moore's character, kind of her soul. And again, you don't realize it until later in the movie, you know, just how completely crazy she really is, you know. But I feel like those are like a little bit of warning signs of what, and also about the darkness of the story itself.
So still on mid-December, the score has a couple of leitmotifs, so musical ideas that return often in the film, as we discussed, varying sometimes depending on the moods of each scene. So I was wondering, how do you choose between reworking a motif to fit a certain scene, a different scene, or writing something new altogether for that scene?
I mean, you try, you know, you. I think one thing that was important was that we never lost sight of the theme. Outside of these ambient pieces that we described, which are kind of a different animal altogether. So it was very important that the music, that we never got so far away from the theme that we lost track of it and it became something completely different. So, you know, I hate to say it sounds very, you know, it's not that I'm trying to skirt out of giving the answer, but it's a lot of experimentation, you know. I mean, you try things and you try them again and try different ways. I mean, for each piece of music that you hear in May December, there were several, sometimes, you know, a dozen attempts or more of different ways that you kind of slowly ratchet up the dramatic effect of the music. And also, this also done a lot in conjunction, you know. A very, very important part of the whole process was the picture editor, Afonso Gonçalves, also a Brazilian fellow, Portuguese-speaking filmmaker, and who really, really had a lot to do with how this music was used. There was no music editor really on this project, but I always find that the relationship of a composer is, at best in a film, is a triangular relationship with a director and a picture editor. And certainly with Afonso, with somebody who I've worked with many, many times for my entire career, and who has been working with Todd Haynes for quite some time too. He was a very, very important part of like, how can we experiment with this crazy idea of using this pre-existing music and all of that. But I think for the most part, it was always about, again, shocking the characters, but also, you know, a lot of the music was cut a lot of the picture was cut to the music too. So, to especially the Legrand stuff. So there is an element of them just cutting to that music, and then we had to re-record it again and kind of sort of redo that. But there's an element of just trial and error.
And this also leads to an interesting question, which is like you mentioned, you've been working with Todd since Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo. And so it bears the question of how has your co-creative process evolved since then, and what does it involve? You speak a little bit about it already. I mean, does Todd, for example, how does he discuss and share his references? You spoke a bit about the lookbook from Ed Asamer, for example, but what was it like in Dark Waters? Was it any different? How has your short words, let's say your shorthand kind of term, has evolved between each other? I'm very interested also in that scenario of him being in the booth and you playing at the same time. Have you ever been scared by his reactions? Okay, don't do this, and reshaped anything, or not really?
No, I've never, no,
Okay.
especially if we're dealing with somebody like Todd, I mean,
Yeah.
that is such a gifted director, and you know that what's happening. Even what I really love about a relationship with a director is that sometimes, and that's why I go back to this idea that music is like a cast member. You're like one of the actors, of the film. Sometimes you don't really understand what the director is going for. But nevertheless, you can follow them. And there's been a few times I've been lucky enough to say, certainly May December is one of them, or Dark Waters too, where I was like, I'm not really sure where this is going, but let's go. And they kind of guide you through it. So the interesting thing with Dark Waters was that I came in very late in the game. There was a change because of scheduling of his usual composer. So I came in when there was like no time. We had a
Right.
few. The music, it was very, very fast. But this idea of somebody directing me on as I play is something that I've done before with other directors, and I've wrote cues also like on a keyboard or something, with like Nicole Holofcener, for instance, is a director that I've worked with many times, and I remember writing cues for Nicole, and she said, I want something like that, and I would play it, and she was like, yeah, that's it. And that kind of a thing is it's very rare, because nowadays, especially since COVID, you don't spend a lot of time in the room with people, but I'm very interested in that part of it, that performative, and maybe that goes back to your question, Miguel, about the piano. Being a pianist and being a classically trained pianist, I find that is always a whole element of music, that is a lot of the times left on the table a little bit because there's not enough time in film, to do certain things. And interpretation, you look at classical piano, you have the same piece being played by 100 different people. It's going to be done in 100 different ways, and some of them will be extremely powerful, and some of them will be, I don't know. So I find that performance part is very, very interesting to me. I had another experience that was kind of like that, where I worked on this movie Journal for Jordan with Denzel Washington, and when I was going to record all the piano parts, Denzel came to the studio and he sat not in the booth, but he sat next to the piano with headphones, and I played the entire score like that, and it was really nerve-wracking at first, but he was really enjoying it, being, of course, the amazing performer that he is, along with being a great director. And there's something about that, it's very intimate, with the piano, which I love, that is like, just him being there, he really influenced how I was playing, first by being terrified and eventually by just, I don't know, just being inspired by this master being there. And it was very similar with Todd. When we recorded the pianos for May December, he was also here always and had a lot to say, and kind of and I love how filmmakers, at best, they are describing music in purely dramatic terms, and they're not going to say, well, can you play more notes or less notes? It's more about what they're looking for in the story. And I find that process, I mean, it's essentially why I do what I do. I just adore working with filmmakers and trying to figure it out. The music is such a mysterious part of a film, I mean, it's so weird how it works and why it works, and so and I find that also, even for very experienced directors like Todd Haynes or Denzel Washington, music is the one part where they're like, it's really for the most part outside of their music tends to be outside of the zone of knowledge of most directors, but that's also kind of part of what's so magical about it. I mean, I feel like there's a point where directors have to really trust somebody, whether it's, in the case of, some directors might choose to just use pre-existing music, like in a lot of like Scorsese or Tarantino movies, or directors like Spielberg that use almost exclusively, one composer. It can be anything, but there's this process of discovery, and I feel like at its best, filmmaking is a process of discovery and of trying to kind of tell a story. And I think as composers and musicians, we have a little bit of an advantage because we're kind of taking the director into this realm that they don't necessarily, they can't really control it. But I always go back to the same thing and say, think of me as one of your actors and just direct me like that. Tell me, talk to me in dramatic terms. And I think that for me has been the best way of translate ideas into music.
Actually, one of the next questions I was going to ask was very much related to that, and delving a little bit into it. Music is really, when you think about it, such an old kind of field of art, older than cinema, really, with its own terminology and principles. And so, one of the things that I cannot help feeling as a young filmmaker and director is that other directors out there starting out, they really, I think, they feel this way about music, where should I know or understand certain key music notions to really learn how to communicate best my intentions to a composer? Do you find that, apparently, do you find that some directors have that difficulty? And would you recommend some key music notions for them to understand so to communicate better? Or just leave it at a stage of express it in dramatic terms? No need to go any further.
I mean, listen, knowledge is knowledge, I think it's always oh, I wouldn't, but I don't think it's necessary. And I have to say, I've been in situations, a few situations with directors that were very knowledgeable and were musicians themselves that can turn into like a nightmare, because
Okay, it's interesting
sometimes
to know.
they might start to like give you very specific notes. I mean, I've never worked with a director that was like that their musical talent matched their directing talent. Let me put it this way. So sometimes that's a dangerous thing. But at the same time, music is so universal and it's so human, that we all have a relationship to music. I mean, it's why when you're working on a film, everybody has something to say. I mean, if you ask 30 people and half of them are in the film world, half of them are just, viewers. They will all have something to say about the music. They might not have something to say about the costumes or the story structure or editing, but music it's very human. My own theory is that I think that, even though music, as you say, is an older form than cinema, I do think in their infancy, for me, it goes back to storytelling. And I think, when we as humans communicated and told stories way, way back in our ancestors' time, people probably were, when they were describing something, they would describe noises of like if they were saying, hey, don't go to the river there because there's a tiger that is going to eat you, they might do the tiger sound, but eventually that might have evolved into more dramatic and a more dramatic thing. But I find that the music, what it does to me in a film is that it tricks our brain into accepting what's happening there as emotional reality. Just like if somebody's telling a story and somebody behind is playing some spooky music or doing spooky sound effects, it hypnotizes you, I think, essentially. I think that's what music does. Now, there's all ways that this can be done, from what May December does to what mainstream Hollywood does, or to something like really riveting and crazy, like Poor Things, there's so many different approaches, or what Tarantino does, but they all, I think, have in common that they kind of trick you. And I think they tricks the brain in thinking that car chase or that kiss or that monster or whatever it is real in our brains. It's experiencing it as reality. I feel like that's a big part of what music does. Now, of course, there are movies that a few, not many, that have no music and they still can be very affecting. But for the most part, I feel like that's part of the alchemy of it. That's why I also think that music in film is more like alchemy than anything, where you are mixing this thing and you're adding this element that it becomes a third thing that is neither of them. I mean, like what Kubrick did without his use of classical music, where the film becomes a different film and the piece of music becomes a different piece of music because of how they're joined together, like using Bartok on The Shining or something like that. You hear that music, it changes the music. It changes the meaning of the music. And of course, the music is changing the meaning of the film too. But I find it that it's more like alchemy. It's like this really crazy magical spice that you throw it into this pot and something else comes out. Hopefully it's gold. Sometimes it's not, but
Yeah, definitely. And following this up, you've worked with many known directors, Robert De Niro, Anton Fuqua, Cary Fukunaga, Denzel Washington. Looking back reflectively at those relationships, if you could sum up what would be ideally the best way, what would be the best way, what would you say would be the best way for the director to communicate, express those intentions? What do you expect in those terms? Is there any way, any advice in that way to be more clear?
yes. The advice, the most important is to have a vision, and to really understand what your vision is. Even if it's not specifically, well, I want exactly this piece of music, but have a vision for what you're going for. I think that trumps everything, because sometimes people don't know what, and this is like where a director like Denzel Washington or Cary Fukunaga or Anton Fuqua, they really know what they're going for. Sometimes, they might fall short of it, or they might, it might become something else that they didn't expect, but having a vision. But otherwise, I would say, yeah, like I said, communicating in dramatic terms is the most effective way. And the one thing that I can say that I've worked with a lot of directors of many, many different styles. But with almost no exception, they all love music, really love music, and are very excited about music. Like when I work with Antoine Fuqua, part of the process is that in the middle of the day, I'll get a text from him saying, "Hey, have you heard this?" And it could be anything. It could be like a pop song, it could be a piece of classical music, could be a piece of an old score. I don't know. But like I find that directors, with almost no exception, really, really love music and really are very keen on sharing what they love with you. So sometimes one of the things that I ask for a director when we start is like, give me a playlist. And now in our age where playlists are so easy to do, give me a playlist of things that you like. Doesn't matter if they relate to the film or not. I just want to get to know the person, and kind of, what are the things that move you or not, And I tend to ask if there's any instrument that they absolutely hate, because,
Okay.
right off the bat, I remember there was a director that I found out much later that he absolutely hated the steel drum, that instrument that they have in Jamaican music. And I hadn't really used that instrument, but I thought it was very, very funny that that it was so specific. But
Yeah.
I like to ask, so if they say, "I really absolutely hate the flute," or "I hate this," or "I hate that," but also, I usually tend to ask for specific examples of what they don't like, because I've also been in situations where a director would say, "I love this cue that you wrote, but I really hate the trumpet when it comes in, but there is no trumpet," and then you have to figure out what that is, and also not, make him feel bad about it. So sometimes it's good to understand, to know what it is, and if there's something that they really love or really hate. Music is so subjective, and I think sometimes just listening is the best way. But a playlist is something that I've really enjoyed, also because selfishly, I have gotten to know many, many different pieces of music that I wouldn't have otherwise by just a director sharing what they love and what moves them.
Yeah, I find very, just to, as a final note, sorry, I find it very interesting because oftentimes I am writing a piece, whether it be a feature or a short film that I'm interested in developing, and I do have create a playlist, and I often have this conflict with myself. Should it be music that will inspire music in the film, so be very similar to what will be the end result, or music that just takes me to a certain place emotionally? So I put everything in. Like you say, sometimes it's not exactly music that I'm going to give the composer later on. It's just music that translates specifically what is that emotional moment for that character in that scene. It might not be even there eventually, but it produces something in you creatively. And also a bit in that sense, I find it very interesting that you mentioned that when you're creating music, there's this trial and error kind of process, a bit like in writing. And so, but it's all part of it. I mean, that victory and failure, let's say, it's part of the creative process, in the intuition taking you there.
Absolutely. I remember I've worked many times with the great Barry Levinson, and Barry used to tell me he tries everything, and he's like absolutely like anything that he feels like it's a good idea, he'll try. But he always said to me this thing that I never forgot. He said, the movie will spit out the music that it doesn't want. So you just have to listen to it, and you just put it against it, and it should be very clear if the movie can take it. Because sometimes, and that was an interesting lesson from somebody like Barry that has done so many movies, is that they realize that the movie is a living thing. And the movie that you as a director and writer are writing in your room might be very, very different. The final movie, because it becomes this, it's kind of like, a recipe that goes to a kitchen, and then you still have like a bunch of all the ingredients and the people working, and that can become quite different. So I think like listening and being open, and creating, I think one of the things that I find that I really attracts me to directors are people, and certainly any of the directors that we've talked about, in this conversation are true to that, where they create a place of a real safe place for people to try things, where they will say, hey, give it a shot, let's see. And without any, if it doesn't work, they say, I don't know, maybe not this, as opposed to, to like, oh my God, what are you doing trying these ideas? So I feel like the really smart directors, they encourage and empower their collaborators. And I'm just one little bit of the film. Music is an important part, but certainly, there's so many other parts that are so integral, and I think creating a safe space for people to do and to do their best and to be able to fail, really. Like you said, it's a bunch of victories, and there is an element of trial and error, that is, it's just a fact of life. I mean, I love to say that I watch a movie and I'm like, okay, I know exactly what this is going to be. But the one thing that I always try to go back to is what gives you, at best, what gives you goosebumps when you're watching and listening. And I think that once you get that, I find that that's something that is one should not ignore.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think, it's about trying.
Yeah, and just going back to something you said before, I remembered, because you said there are always films that have no music. And I wondered if you were ever in a situation where you actually thought maybe this scene or this moment shouldn't have music.
Well, all the time, yeah. I mean, when I was more in the beginning of my career, when you're very hungry, you want to put music everywhere and all of that. But also, there are moments that it's just more effective without it. I mean, I would say that for my money in contemporary film, most films are overscored, in my opinion, including many that I've worked on. I mean, sometimes I feel like you have to let it breathe. And sometimes it is the rare film that has no music whatsoever that will work. I mean, I think of like, No Country for Old Men. It was fantastic. There is no score until the final credits. I mean, Zone of Interest, which is out this year. I mean, there is music, but essentially there is no music in the film. I read, Mika Levy describing it and saying that they tried, and in the end, what wins is what's the most powerful thing, So, yeah, there are a lot of times when, and there was even a time with a director that wanted to work with me, and they sent me the movie. It's a director that never worked with composers, and I said, okay, let's give it a shot and see. We tried and we worked for a while, and then eventually became clear that it was, you're better off with no music. And I had to say it. Listen, I think it's better with no music. What can I tell you? And he agreed, and then it was fine. So I think Music is obviously, I find it enormously important, but I don't think it's a given. And I think if a scene works better without it, then a scene works better without it. And it is sometimes, any composer will tell you it's very painful, when you write this thing and you think it's fantastic and they take it out. But that's part of the creative process, and that's where, going back to my comment about what a director should bring to the table, vision is the most important thing. And if a director is very convinced that something should or should not have music, I trust them, because I feel like ultimately I'm there at the service of the director, because they know the story so much more intimately and better than I do. I think it's good to come with a fresh approach. A composer, usually you come into a movie when it's been shot already, so you get to see it not for what they thought it was going to be, but kind of for what it is, and that's very important. But I remember working on The Good Shepherd with Robert De Niro, and he told me, I've been developing this movie for like 12 years. So, it's kind of like, you gotta really listen. They've been thinking about this thing for a long time, and they pondered a lot of things. And but even with Robert De Niro, he was certainly open to suggestions and was open to thinking of things differently. But ultimately, I think as a composer of film music, you are working at the service of a director and trying to make their vision come to life.
By the way, one question. How was it working with Robert De Niro in that film? Which, by the way, I have to say, your score for The Good Shepherd, I think it's very emotional. There's one particular piece, which is Edward's Secret, I think. That is very powerful. I found it very interesting. I think it's a beautiful example of your skill at the piano in that film.
That was an experience that was very early on in my career. As I was doing, I realized I had no business being there, because it was all these big people working, and he was phenomenal. I really connected with him. He was somebody that was very emotional in how he listens to music and how he expresses himself. I have learned so much. I mean, and this is the interesting thing also, that I feel very lucky. I feel like with each director that I work with, they teach you so much about film and film music, and with De Niro, it was all about restraint, which is something that you can really see in his acting. Although he's played some of the craziest, most violent characters, when you actually look at what he's doing, rarely he's speaking above. He's very quiet when he's acting. He tends to be very quiet. And he used to talk about intense restraint, and how, like, you can have all this real emotional thing, but with the minimum effort. I would put Denzel Washington in a similar place, where these actors understand that, like, the minimum, like, and also the use of music in their acting, which is it's a whole thing. Like, working with Denzel and Francis, I could see he understood the acting that he did so well. He had done that as a play, and he knew every word. And it was so interesting to see how protective they can be, because sometimes the difference between great acting in a movie or overacting can be the music. You can have a great scene, and if the music pushes it too far, it will make that actor seem like they're overacting. And this is something that I really learned with De Niro. He was very there. The performers like that are very in tune with what the music does. So De Niro, Denzel, and I worked with Jodie Foster as well. They all really know, because I'm sure they all have been in situations where they looked at a film that they worked on, and all of a sudden there's this piece of music, and makes them, like, not be what they hoped that it would be. And that's why it's so fascinating when they're directing and acting, and you get, they have, like, the total power of the thing, and it's an incredibly enlightening experience.
Yeah, it's a very interesting perspective. I never see, thought of it that way, because an actor, of course, seeing himself in the aftermath in the film, he really has the final measure of the music against the performance. So it's a very interesting insight. But I'll let Miguel pass on to the next question.
Yeah, so looking in retrospect, how often do you change your perception of your work after seeing the films? So whether they elevate what you had done or perhaps the opposite, are there cases of music you're very proud of that sadly are in projects that couldn't properly give your work the attention it deserved?
I mean, there's always, you always look back and things could have been different, could have been, but I don't know. I feel like a movie is also a moment in time, that things come together. There is an element of the chemistry of the whole thing that nobody can quite control it. I do think that for my money, movies and by extension, I think TV, the way that it's being done now with a more sophisticated, is really the most powerful art form that we have at our disposal at this point, because it combines everything. But because of that, it also sometimes it just doesn't work. When I've been in situations where you're like, I get what you're trying to do here, but it just didn't come off, and can be kind of sad. But I tend to not ponder too much and kind of look forward. I mean, for me, the most exciting score is always the one I'm about to do. But there are definitely a lot of heartaches when you're working in things. But the more you do them too, you start to think of the totality of your work, and everything adds up. But you don't live or die by this one thing. And I tend to also defer to the director if there's been many times where I disagree with the director about what we were about to do, but I would still do it. And I would say, listen, I don't really feel it, but I'm doing it. Here you go. And I would say that sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm not, and I think directors have a way of listening to music and experiencing music that is so different from what a composer does. But I find that that thermometer is really, really, really crucial, because as a composer, I am looking at a scene and I am really paying attention to what the music is doing, particularly if it's a movie I'm working on. But as a director, they have to step back and just, that's why sometimes you have music in film that can be extremely simple, almost be nothing, but be extremely effective. And maybe when you listen to it on its own, it's like, well, I don't know about that. So I think that there's all kinds, sometimes there's been scores that I feel like were superior to the movies that they were in, that I worked on. But it was what it was. And there are times where I feel like, maybe the movie was better than my score. So, it happens both ways.
Surely, that there's, I think,
Yeah.
as an artist, whether you are a music composer or an editor or director, particularly with starting out, there's this preciousness about what we are creating and defending it. And perhaps you want it to always be right. And I think there's something with the ego that it will always turn out as I wish it to be. But as life goes on and you start collaborating with other people, there's this thing of compromise. And in cinema, particularly being a collaborative art, you kind of start realizing how there are dividends to be gained with the collaboration. And you really see that side of trial and error. I'll do this one. I know you want it. I don't feel it, but let's try. And suddenly you feel like, oh shit, you were right. This
Exactly.
works. Yeah.
You have to be open to that possibility. I think it's to be open to that. I mean, of course, sometimes, and as a director, those are the tough decisions. You only have another hour and you might have to say, sorry, I got what I need. We need to get another scene now. And so that is also, I think the whole experience on the set and all that, which I have next to no experience with, because I'm in post-production, is very incredibly nerve-wracking because it also costs so much, and I think it's a little easier in the music realm to make mistakes and try different things because you can always do it again, but you can't always go back and reshoot something, that you did.
We have a final question. So beyond the composing, do you find yourself often playing a role in the sound editing, namely when and how to incorporate your music in the film in specific scenes? Or is
Wait.
it something that ha
You mean the
usually
music editing or the sound editing? What
the sound editing, yeah.
the sound design of it, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
Design of background noises and things like that, you mean?
No, in the sense that you're trying to help the director know where to incorporate your music in the film, and if this is
Oh
something that happens all the time or
Yeah, that's what that's a part of the process. It's usually the first thing that we do after the prelim. The first real official business tends to be the spotting session where you sit down and go through the movie and discuss where music should be and not. Sometimes there's a temp score that maybe already gives an idea. Sometimes there isn't. But yes, that process is key. It's very, very, very important to kind of decide where it goes. And also I always think of it as a roadmap. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's all that the music is gonna, that there's only gonna be music on those spots. When but I also always am a big fan of saying, hey, let's put music everywhere that you think there might be music, and then eventually we take it out, you know. And to one of your points about whether sometimes I suggest taking the music out, I even as late as the dub, when we're doing the final mix, there are cues. Sometimes I think it's good to have a little bit more music than you need, and then remove things towards the end. It's a little bit, I always think of, there's that Coco Chanel thing, that Coco Chanel said that when you left the house, you should go in front of the mirror and take out one accessory, you know. So in their case, a scarf or a earring or something, you know. And I think that music, you know, there's something to be said for that. And I find that it's important to know where music should go, but just as important to know where it shouldn't go. And I think up until the very end, and that's something that I see, there are pieces of music that sometimes, and I'm not really sure until I see it in a run, if we really need music here or if we're really missing music in a certain spot, you know.
And that was the latest from Marcelo Zarvos, folks. We would like to thank his presence here today. He is truly an excellent filmmaker. And remember to check out May-December on Netflix or in a theater next to you. If you're a filmmaker running the festival marathon, feel free to send us a message for an interview as well. We would love to promote your work. Don't forget to subscribe, share this interview, or simply give us a like. That's how our podcast can grow ever more groovy. And if you're on YouTube and want to see more interviews like this, check out this next video right here. Thank you for listening and see you next time.